Welcome to another morning talk. It's on Thursday morning on the Easter Retreat 2010. And another day has gone past on the meditation retreat, which means another day closer to your enlightenment. If it's going to happen one day, that means 24 hours closer to it. So always look at the positive side of whatever you have to do. But today's talk is alluded to it a little bit last night in some of the questions and answers. I haven't talked about the path of insight yet and how insight works into all this practice, which I've been teaching for the last 5, 6, or 7 days. Because sometimes still people come and say, oh, you just teach samatha, just calming down. You should teach insight. And I keep telling people this is insight meditation. As I said last night even, if you can't do anapanasati, do breath meditation, can't do breath meditation, do metta meditation, can't do metta meditation, do loving kindness, you can't do loving kindness, do vipassana, if you can't do vipassana, do insight, if you can't do insight, do letting go, if you can't do letting go, go back to breath meditation. Because it really is one and the same thing. And just two little similes, golden oldie stories, which make it very clear what's going on and why it works. One of the most powerful stories, which I use many, many times, is just this road up Kingsbury Drive. If you want to do this yourself, I'm sure that many of you, you've gone up to the monastery, you've gone up to Jhana Grove, always in your car. So I challenge you, you've got plenty of time, just go down the bottom of the hill and walk up. Walk up, it's only 2.83 kilometres from the bottom, and walk up. And all of you who have been coming up here for years will have the same experience which I had when I first did that. Just about 7 years, I think, I've been here. Beautiful day like today, then just came back early from somewhere. Told the driver, I need some exercise, I just want to have a nice walk. So drop me off at the bottom of the hill, which is what they did. And so I walked up the hill. Now to the monastery, it's only 2 and a bit kilometres. And as I was walking up the hill, something very strange happened. Something very weird happened. It's a shame you know this story, because I can't sort of build it up at all. But I do try my best. I felt totally lost. I just could not recognize my surroundings at all. The whole hillside was totally different than everything I remembered after 7 years of living in that monastery, going up and down that hill maybe 2 or 3 times a week. It was totally different. And that shocked me. What's going on? Have I lost my mind? You know what it's like in a meditation retreat? Sometimes that's what you think. You've lost your mind because you get into weird stuff. Me, I love weird stuff. More weird stuff, bring it on. Well, you know, it's a boring life as a monk. You know, you can't sort of watch movies. You can't sort of do all the sort of stuff you get into. So a bit of weird stuff in your meditation, that's like, you know, monk's sort of sci-fi movie. That's our special effects, which happens in meditation. So anyway, you're walking up the hills. I couldn't recognize. When I was, this whole place looked totally different. So different, it just was unrecognizable. And so I stopped. And that's when it changed again. And my goodness, this was really weird stuff. Throwing my brain into confusion. What was going on? But it wasn't so confused, because when I stopped, that hillside was incredibly beautiful. It was actually, the beauty was more striking than the fact I just couldn't recognize it. And of course, contemplated afterwards what was going on, why did that happen? And it had a perfectly rational explanation. Nothing sort of psychic powers or anything, it's all rational. And the rational explanation was, when you're looking through the window of a speeding car, even just going 40, 50 kilometres an hour. But if some of our anagarikas drive it, you know, it's even 100 kilometres an hour, you know, even up the hill. So anyway, looking through the window of a speeding car, just your eyes don't have time to have a proper image formed on the back of your retina. It's a chemical reaction. You all know some biology. So when light hits the back of the eye, there's a chemical reaction and it forms an image. I remember as a kid, you know, in sort of school, just, what was it doing? Developing your own photographs. So you take a photograph, you take it and then put it in the chemical, and you see that actually, it took a 2 or 3 minutes, I forget exactly how long, this blank piece of paper, and because it was in the chemicals, you start to see that the image slowly forming. It took 2 or 3 minutes to fully form. It's a chemical reaction on the photographic plate. And it's exactly what happens in the back of the eye. So it takes a bit of a while for the image to form, for the shapes to actually to appear, and especially for the colours to fully form. And when you're looking through the window of a car, you just don't have time to do that. Before another image comes up, dislodges the old one, and another image, and another image. What that really means is you don't really see what's out there. You just see a tiny fraction of what's out there. The colours aren't rich. And the detail is just smudged. But you're used to that, you don't notice it. But when you go slowly, so I was just walking. So actually the images on that hillside had more time to form a more complete image on the back of my eye. So I could actually literally see more. Everything was clearer, more precise. You saw more detail. Everything looked much, much more clear and beautiful. But nothing was as good as when I just stood absolutely still. Because when I stood still, that was the only time my eyes had the full time to have a complete image. And that's when you started to notice things which had not formed in the back of your eye before. The lichen on trees, little rocks, little flowers poking up from within the grass. Not only that, the colours were really deep and rich. Simply because they had time to develop on the back of my retina. And now my mind had time to explore everything. That was just so beautiful. I say that's actually what happens to you on this retreat. You're not going so fast. So you've got no place to go. Just the kitchen, toilet, your room, back again. It's not much of a rush to get anywhere, is it? Okay, sometimes there is traffic jams after the talk as you go out. Or there might be sort of a queue at the breakfast table. But it's not that sort of much stress in this place. And because you can go slowly, you notice much more. And what you notice, because you can be still, the colours become richer and deeper. And to me that sort of showed the connection between stillness and insight. If you're going fast and your mind is moving too fast, let alone your body, then you just simply do not have enough stillness to see everything which is out there, or even in here. You just see fractions, just silhouettes. And also, whatever you experience has not got any depth, not any richness, no beauty. And that was actually the striking thing about that simile. It also involved the fact that when you go still, not only do you see things clearly, but you also get this incredible happiness with what you see. All coming from stillness. What you see is richer, more meaningful. The hillside has never been as beautiful as when I was absolutely still. Because that's when you could see it fully. And of course, you use that simile, the way that people live their lives, always rushing around from one thing to another. And I'm not talking about physically, even mentally, which is why you're going so fast, you can't really see what's really out there. You can't hear properly. You can't feel deeply. And you certainly can't know what's going out there, because your mind is going too fast to form a proper image. So that's one of the reasons why I stress this calming down, slowing, making peace, being kind, being gentle. So you can slow down to the max. Hopefully you can slow down completely. And that's when you see the full Dhamma. If you move, you miss it. So stillness, according to the Buddha, the quote is, and this is not just in one sutta, it's just hundreds of suttas, Samadhi pachaya yathabhuta yana dasana. From stillness. Stillness is the cause for seeing things as they truly are. Because we move too much, we miss too much. So you find that in this retreat. The slower you go, the more you feel, the deeper you hear, the richer whatever you look at becomes. Even I notice this. The longer you stay in this retreat, the quieter you become, the more delicious the food becomes. Food is always the same. It's just your taste buds. Your mind is going so slow, you can pick up tastes where there was none there before, or very little left. You're far more sensitive. And this is part of the joy of a retreat. As you get to the last part of the retreat, your senses see so much. And this retreat center gets more and more beautiful every day, if your mind gets more and more still. That's nature. So what's actually happened there? You're making the connection between stillness, joy, and insight. They all go together. And to emphasize that, Ajahn Chah used to have his simile. And it was a simile of the hand. Now you see the front of my hand, now you see the back of my hand. Front, back. But even if you see the back of my hand, the front is still there, just you can't see it. Front is there, but the back is right behind. You can't separate the back and the front of a hand. That was his simile. But you always develop your teacher's similes and make a few of your own. So my simile, again another golden oldie, was the couple, the Buddhist meditating couple, who one evening they had their dinner and they decided to go on a walk up Meditation Mountain. And the couple, her name was Vipassana and her husband's name was Sam Atta. So Sam Atta and Vipassana, this couple, they went up the Meditation Mountain for a nice walk in the evening. But, as you'd expect, they took their dog. And you know what their dog's name was? Metta. Yeah, Metta the dog. So Sam Atta, Vipassana, and Metta the dog went up the mountain. And you know what happened? First of all, Sam said, I want to go up there because it's so peaceful and calm up that mountain. And Vipassana said, I want to go up there because it's got a glorious view. You can see everything up on top of that mountain. And Metta the dog, he just went up there because they were going up there. So the three of them, they started walking up Meditation Mountain. And the higher they got, the more peaceful it was. The higher they got, the further you could see. The higher they got, the more the little Metta the dog wagged her tail. She was getting happier and happier. Because the path of insight, stillness and joy is a gradual process. The higher you get, the more you see, the more peaceful it is, and the more happiness you have. And when they got to the top of Meditation Mountain, oh, Vipassana, she took out her camera. You could see forever. You get so many insights up on top of Meditation Mountain. Everything, wherever you look, you can see. And as for Sam, oh, you wouldn't believe how still it was up there. Absolutely peaceful. So far above the world. And Metta the dog, she was wagging her tail like it was going to fall off. Running like round in circles like dogs do when they sort of get excited and they're really happy. Ah, oh, Metta the dog was blissing out. But also, Vi, even though that she was enjoying the view, she also enjoyed the peace. And she too was happy like her dog. Sam, yeah, he was enjoying the peace, but he could also see the view. And he too was happy. And as for little Metta the dog, he or she could see the view. I don't know if she's very peaceful, wagging her tail so much, but certainly there's a lot of peace up there. The reason is because on top of Meditation Mountain, peace, this incredible calmness and stillness, insight, being able to see anything you wish, and joy all coexist on Meditation Mountain. So, by encouraging people to be peaceful, I'm not neglecting insight at all. In fact, insight is going right behind what you've been doing. This is insight meditation, as it is calm meditation, as it is metta meditation. You cannot separate them at all. And you will realize that. Because as you get calmer and calmer, the insights start to come. You get wise. And of course, there are two types of insight. And the first type of insight is perhaps the most important for you. It's like the insight into how to meditate. So throughout this whole time you've been here, you've been making many mistakes. and sometimes you press the right button. You're learning what this meditation really is and how it works. And of course you know that you've got an insight that meditation's working, because you get peaceful. You're going up meditation mountain. You can actually become more clear, you can see more. And of course you get happier. So those are the three signs you're making progress. More peace, more clarity, more happiness. But of all those three, the easiest to recognize is happiness. Metta the dog is easier to recognize than Sam or Vi. Because insight, so many people sort of come up and say they have insights. They say these profound things, really meaningful rubbish. And sometimes it doesn't help them at all. Sometimes they come, I've seen the Dhamma, I'm enlightened. And they go home and they argue with their wife, they get divorced and they get sort of a nervous breakdown. You're supposed to be enlightened for goodness sake. No, it's just those insights are very tricky. So you can never measure your progress. Or it's very dangerous to measure your progress by all these insights you have. Because many people don't recognize the difference between thoughts and concepts and insights. The difference is where they come from. Real insights come from stillness. These other things are just ideas. Come from thinking. They're not the same. That's why insight is very, very difficult to sort of assess. Even stillness. Stillness you can know, but my goodness. Sometimes, you know, I think that I'm as still as you could possibly become. And then you go to another level of stillness which you could never imagine existed. So even stillness is incredibly powerful and deep. But the joy is something you can't miss. So you know you're making progress. If your joy, your metta, is getting stronger and stronger and stronger, that's the greatest sign. But focusing on the insight, the question people often ask is, do you have to do insight? You don't do insight no more than you do stillness. The last 6 or 7 days I've been sort of stressing the point, you don't do this practice, just this practice happens. I didn't have to tell myself when I slowed down on that hillside, now you've got to enjoy all the trees. It's just right there in front of you, you can't miss it, plain as your nose, if you look in the mirror. So, insight happens naturally. And it's one of the sayings of the Buddha. It was one of these suttas which, when anybody reads it, it just really strikes you. Because it says this whole process, you know, from even like when you have pity, one who has pity, this joy, this enthusiasm, you don't have to make the determination. You don't even have to will. May my body be tranquil. It just happens as a natural result. In one who is joy, your body is tranquil. And one who is tranquil, you don't have to make the determination, you don't even have to try, may I feel happy. Happiness just comes as a result of that tranquility. And one who has such a happiness, they don't have to will, they don't have to try, may my mind become still. May my mind get into jhanas. You don't have to make that determination, it happens naturally when your mind is happy. That is a powerful thing to understand, and that is so true. You don't do anything, you just create the causes and off you go. And one who has stillness, you don't have to make an effort, you don't need to will. Oh, may I see things as they truly are. It happens as a natural result. You see things as they truly are. And when you see things as they truly are, you don't need to make the will. You don't need to determine, may I now become enlightened, it just happens. This total natural cause and effect sequence, which is one of the great discoveries of the Buddha. It just happens automatically, you can't stop it. It's nothing to do with you. It's just this cause and effect process. No more than if the tree decides to put forth its blossoms, no more than the blossom suddenly one day decides, oh, I better make some fruit today. It just happens cause and effect, you can't stop it. Nor can you generate it, nor can you make it slower or faster. It just happens. It's a wonderful little teaching to understand just the nature of cause and effect and how it works on insight. So the stiller you are, the more you'll understand. But of course, the understanding or the insight, first of all, should be dependent upon, or rather focused on, your meditation practice. How can I become more still? What's going on? Where do these thoughts come from? Where do these feelings come from? Why can't I sit still? So please focus the insight on the meditation practice first of all. So it's not really just some theoretical conceptual practice so you can write a book somewhere. Your insight is going to help you meditate deeper and get deeper into meditation. And that's why the insight which you develop along the path of meditation, along the path of stillness, is one of the most powerful factors which will get you deeper and deeper and deeper so you can see more and more and more. Which is why that, you know, I give so many talks about sort of how to become still. So many sort of similes and stories and pieces of advice, because these are all the insights which I have gained over these years. Basic ones that making peace, being kind, being gentle, not doing anything is the way to be still. And you pick up your cup, when is the water going to be still? Whenever you hold it, it never gets still. You put it down and become still. You've done that, you've seen that, I've tried, and you just get agitated, or you get to a certain level of stillness, but you can't get further. But you start letting go, you pull it down, and you really get still. Every time in my meditation, if I get stuck somewhere, and I don't put more effort in, I used to try that, you know, you get so far, come on Ajahn Brahm, get your act together, go deeper. That type of mind which sort of strives and just put forth extra effort, that just sends you backwards. You've tried that, but then you've tried the opposite. I just let it be. This is good enough for me. You know, I'm a Westerner. What chance have I got to become enlightened? You know, I've been too much studying. I've wrecked my brain with too much knowledge at university. So you say, I just let it go. I'll just be stupid monk. And when you say things like that, then you get very deep, you get wise monk then. So you're not trying, to get somewhere to attain. It's not part of your ego and all the things which you've attained and earned and owned over this lifetime. You let all of that go and just, whatever happens is good enough for me. That's one of those other mantras which you were asking yesterday about, do you know any other mantras as well as I will die, that's for sure. And I gave you the shut up mantra. Shut up mantra is good, but something even more deep than that. And it's a great mantra for you to use when you're walking, when you're meditating, and that is good enough. So when you're breathing in, good, breathing out, enough. Good enough. Good enough. It's a great mantra, because number one, it's positive, it's good. And it's enough. What more do you want? I know that sometimes you read in these newspapers, you know, people who are in strife, and they say, all I want is to get rid of my cancer, that's all I want in life. Yeah, sure thing, as soon as that's gone, you want something else. You know, some immigrants, sort of boat people coming into the country, say, all I want is just, you know, some peace and security. Of course that's not what I want, they give them that and want something else. You know, all I want is to win the lottery once. Yeah, of course, you win it once, you buy a ticket the next day. Oh, it's all I want, all I want, all I want. It's endless. Some people say, all I want is animitta. If I just get animitta on this retreat, then I'll be happy. Yeah, of course. As soon as you want got one animitta, you want another one. And then another one. And then a jhana. And then a second jhana. And a third jhana. And you keep on going with all this wanting business. Insight should come up and say, this is good enough. What more do you want? All these attainments have no end. The attitude, when you say good enough, there you make an end, right here. The end of craving, the end of will, the end of moving, the end of all this coming and going, the end of all this agitation and wanting. Well, the Buddha said, when you want something, that's called dukkha, because it separates you from where you are and where you want to be. You are now divided. You're not a one anymore. Here I am, and I want to be over there. That's called wanting. A separation, a divide, called dukkha. So how do you solve that problem? Not by getting over there. As soon as you get over there, you want to be somewhere else. That's why it's the agitated mind. So instead of trying to get over there, just be happy where you are. This is good enough. This is enough for me. This will do. And then you can rest and relax. Then you can become enlightened by not going anywhere, by just being here. And I was saying on that talk a couple of mornings ago, yesterday I forget, which I lose track of time, when you are here, when you are just content to be here, when you don't go anywhere, that's when things start to happen. Being in the moment, yeah, it's still, but it's a stillness which grows. It's not a static stillness. It's a stillness which deepens and deepens and deepens as you get more and more peaceful. And that's the amazing thing about the meditation practice, to see that I'm not going anywhere and all this thing is happening. When I go somewhere, nothing happens. The more I move, the less it works. The more I do absolutely nothing and sit still, the more these things happen and I'm on the path. So it's a still path. You're still and things happen to you. So that's an insight you get on the path. Every time you want something, you miss the boat. I remember this morning when I was, one of the anecdotes, these monks were making their robes, doing the dyeing in the dyeing shed, and when, this was tired a long time ago, very rare, sometimes weeks or months before you saw any tea or sugar or coffee or anything like that. But if you were doing your dyeing, you had to stay up all night, because it was a continuous work. So people who were doing the dyeing were allowed to actually have tea and coffee. And so, one morning, people had been doing dyeing in the shed, and I woke up at 3:15. And I was a really early riser, before the bell went. And I was at 3:15, and I thought, it's really early, but it's a waste of time going back to sleep because the bell will go in 15 minutes. And I thought, there are guys over there, they've got some of the tea and coffee on over there. I'm sure they wouldn't mind if I went over there and just asked them for a cup of coffee, because, we're really friendly. Even though it's just not really according to the rules, they'll give me a cup of tea and coffee. And at 3:00 in the morning, having a good cup of tea or a cup of coffee, just when you haven't slept all that much, that's wonderful. That's one of the great joys of monastic life, just one half a cup of coffee. Just, you're so sensitive that would really sort of make your meditation really amazing that morning. But then I thought, no, that's craving. And I'm a monk, I shouldn't have craving. And it's against the rules anyway. So I thought, no, it's the wrong thing to do. So I got up and started walking to the dyeing shed. Even though I realized it was the wrong thing to do, my craving was too strong. So off I was walking there. And I actually heard the bell ring as a halfway on the journey. When I got there, I was so disappointed. They'd finished, they'd cleaned up, and it was all, everyone was gone. So I thought, never mind, they must have finished really early and got a bit of sleep. But later on in the day, after I went to the chanting, they said, where were you at 3:00 in the morning? I said, I was walking to the dining shed to get a cup of coffee. So that's really weird, they said, because we were walking to your hut to bring you a cup of coffee in bed. And we'd actually just got on parallel paths. We missed each other. And it really told me that was actually somebody teaching me a lesson. If you want something to happen, you go for it. You never get it. If you just sit here, if I'd just been in my hut and just done absolutely nothing, I'd have got my coffee. But when I went searching for it, I missed it. And it's one of those little lessons you'll always remember in life. When you go for it, you miss it. You sit here and it comes to you. So those are the sorts of insights which I've got in my meditation practice. And even I do now, whenever I get stuck, I don't use effort or willpower, I use insight. Why am I stuck? Why isn't the meditation going anywhere? Why aren't you peaceful and still? Because remember what Ajahn Chah said, you're like a leaf. The only reason that leaf moves is because of the wind. When the wind stops, the leaf moves less and less and less and less until it's perfectly still. The nature of a leaf is to be still. And he said the nature of your mind is also to be still. That's its nature. That's its ground state. So why the heck can't you be still? Because you are doing something. You are the wind. So I always remember that saying, so whenever I'm not still, whenever there's some sort of agitation or suffering, I say, what am I doing? And so I don't try harder to make my mind still. I look, where is Ajahn Brahm interfering? Where have I got my little fingers in there, meddling? So that's where I use my insight, and look and look and look and look and look. There it is. And as soon as you see where you're meddling, really you just have to see it. And then automatically you take your fingers out. You've been caught red-handed. You take your fingers out. And it always happens, and it's a lovely experience. As soon as you see what the problem is,
whoosh, you go deeper into your meditation path. It's just like, you know, there's been a blockage, like, you know, in the toilets, and as soon as you sort of release that blockage, everything flows where it's supposed to flow. And that's what insight does, it unblocks the mind. You've got all the energy and power, it's flowing that way, but there's a blockage there. You remove that blockage and whoosh, you really go deep very quickly. And that's what I've always seen. That's why I use insight in a part of meditation. You see, so what's going on? There's always some sort of wanting or some sort of negativity. Can be expectation, especially the way I teach, because there's a great danger when you start talking about jhanas and describing them and calling them like a bliss better than sex. There's an advantage in that because, you know, it's one, it's an accurate description and it means it motivates you, but also it gives you a heck of a lot of desire and craving. Only 2 days to go, I haven't got it yet, if I don't get it quick, I'll be in big trouble, my chance is gone. So it has that danger of getting too much expectations. So you also look, when you're meditating, what do you expect in this meditation? You're going to have good meditations and bad meditations like everybody else. You know, you're going to have times when it's so easy and times when it's not so easy. What do you expect? So sometimes I ask my other question, what do I expect? Nothing much. Just this. I'm totally out of control. Just the path happens, not me. I'm not a traveller. So I don't expect this to be perfect. I don't expect my body to be without pain. I don't expect to have myself sleep deeply every evening. I don't expect to like the lunch every day. I don't expect to be without tummy ache or headache or some other ache. I don't expect the meditators not to sort of snore or to make noises. I don't expect people to close the door silently. I expect it to bang every now and again. So this is what, you don't have any expectations. That's why you become very peaceful. Don't have any expectations of yourself. And then life becomes so still. So the insight is no expectations. I already mentioned just one of the great insights, because the greatest insight is all about anicca dukkha anatta. And especially the anatta stuff. One of the greatest insights you have is you're totally out of control. So it's a waste of time trying to control the meditation. It just makes it worse. The nicest thing is just anatta. What I mentioned last night, the other mantra, none of my business. If you breathe in, not my, breathe out, business. Not my business. Not my business. Someone makes a noise in your cottage, not my business. That's their bad karma. A thought comes in your mind, not my business. You're peaceful, you're agitated, not my business. You get nimittas or you fall asleep, not my business. That degree of anatta just makes life so easy. It means hardly anything disturbs you. You get more and more deep, more and more peaceful. Because you're using insight to drive your meditation, not your will. I always try to actually to connect basic Buddhist teachings to the path of meditation. So many other teachers, they teach, you know, Buddhism, suttas and meditations as if they're two separate animals. They're connected. So I already mentioned, remember the first talk I gave here? The two types of meditation? Second Noble Truth and Third Noble Truth meditation. There's another insight you can use. If you are suffering, if you're not satisfied with this meditation happening right now, what's the cause? Because you've done Second Noble Truth meditation, that's why it's not working. Desire, 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 want, want, crave, 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 leads to suffering. And sometimes, you know, that happened to me, and I think, what's going wrong here? I think, stupid, look, the Buddha said that, the first sermon, Four Noble Truths, the most basic teaching of Buddhism. You've been wanting something, and you're suffering. What do you expect, stupid monk? And when I first started seeing that, see, well, I'm not going to do Second Noble Truth meditation before. But it also meant every time I was unsatisfied with my meditation, every time I was suffering, Instead of saying, I've been doing something wrong, I should be trying harder, I realized it was my attitude I was craving. I was doing Second Noble Truth meditation. That became a huge insight into Four Noble Truths. When I did Third Noble Truth meditation, letting go, and all those four ways of letting go I taught the other day, what are those four ways of letting go? Throwing things away, number one. Number two? Yeah, contentment, being happy to be here. Number three, giving, not expecting anything back in return, yeah, no expectations. And four, Teflon, right? See, this is what you learn at sort of school. You repeat the lessons and people say it back to you. And it actually gets in there, I now brainwash you again. So it reinforces those messages, so it becomes your insight, or how you meditate. So if you do letting go meditation, leads to happiness, to peace, to freedom, to nirvana. So I know also, when I'm doing my insight practice, if the meditation is going really nicely, getting really peaceful, yeah, that's Third Noble Truth you've just been practicing. So these Second and Third Noble Truths are not theories. They're actually practical advice on how to meditate. Third Noble Truth, you let go. It goes all the way to Nibbana. And the more peaceful you are, the more clear you are, the happier you are, the more you've got Meditation Mountain, the more you're getting closer and closer to Nibbana. So that Third Noble Truth is the way up Meditation Mountain. The Second Noble Truth is the way down Meditation Mountain. So understanding that, you get a great insight into some of the basic teachings of the Buddha. And one of those nicest insights which people they've got on the question time, they said, well, all this letting go business, you know, you're really letting go of this self. You're not doing things. I'm very pleased that you've got that connection between the doer and will and the creation of an ego, a self, a me. There's a 100% one-for-one connection there. The more you do, the more you crave, the more you create an ego, a self. And to be able to let go of craving, let go, you can do it for a small time in meditation retreat, but to start letting it go completely is very scary because you're letting go of your most cherished possession, your ego, your sense of self. And that's why this whole path of letting go, of doing nothing, of not judging yourself. No good meditation, bad meditation. You fall asleep, that's fine by me. If you get into nimittas and jhanas, when you come to your meditation interviews, I'll say exactly the same. You've just been asleep, you've had a terrible time, you've just been contemplating all sorts of terrible things you want to do to the people in your cottage. And I will say to you, very good. And you say, I just had jhana, fourth jhanas, I've seen all these things, I've become a stream winner. I will say, very good. I give you exactly the same response. Reason being, because we're not judging anybody. We're not making any differences between people. You do that, why? Because you know anatta, no self. It's not you, you haven't attained anything. You've just done more disappearing, that's all. So how can you praise yourself? It's like just when you finally become an arahat. It's like pinning the medal so that on an empty person. There's just no way where the pin can actually stick. And this is why it's just nothing there. One of those great stories. Again, this is really not a golden oldie, but a diamond oldie. That time when I'd just come out of a very deep meditation. It was when Ajahn Chah was visiting our monastery for his weekly sauna. After an inspiring talk, you know, inspiration really gets your meditation going. And he gave one of these really inspiring talks, and you really get into it, and I just got so much happiness. Usually you'd help him with his sauna, do some duties, which is what we do as monks for our teacher. But that day there were other monks, and I was just too high. So I went in a quiet place around the back of the hall, sat down and meditated. And it's so easy to meditate when you're inspired. You've got a really nice deep meditation, and you don't know how long you're meditating for. You come out afterwards, and you're just bright-eyed, blissed out. And the thought was, maybe there's still some time to do some chore for my teacher. So I went walking towards the sauna. I was too late, because I saw him coming the opposite direction. We were going to pass each other. And he was with two Thai lay people. They were going to take him back to their car to drive him back to his monastery. And that was when we passed. Before we passed, he looked at me. These great teachers, these great monks, the way that Ajahn Chah looked to you, it was just, it was what I always remember by Ajahn Chah. He can be funny, he can also be really serious, and he can also grab you. His facial features were brilliant. And he grabbed me, made me stop. And he knew, you know, you don't have to be sort of a great sort of meditator to know that someone is checking you out and reading your mind. So he was actually going right into me. And I had a beautiful meditation. So that's why he was interested. And so when he came out, that's when he asked me, Brahma Wangso. I say it in Thai because there's a few Thai people here. Brahma Wangso. Tamai. Which meant, Brahma Wangso. Why? He asked me this question, why? This was serious. This was no joke. Sometimes Ajahn Chah could be a great joker, but this was not. This was serious. And I just was still for a few moments, and the answer came up, I don't know. I was really a young monk, yeah. I got a nice meditation, but I wasn't that wise. And of course, you know, when, you know, you make a fool of yourself in front of your teacher, the teacher never actually scolds you. He just laughs. You know, we created so, you know, the stupid Western monks at that monastery, we created so much fun and laughter for Ajahn Chah. I'm sure we cheered him up no end, the stupid antics of the Western monks. So he thought it was terribly funny. And he laughed his head off, and then he stopped and looked at me again. And that's when he said, I'll tell you the answer. The answer to the question why, coming from one of the great monks of our age, an enlightened being, the answer to the question why. And he said, if anyone asks you, I will tell you the answer. So the answer to the question why is, my me are I. Which means, there's nothing, nothing there. He looked at me and said, do you understand? And I said, yes. He said, no you don't. It was a wonderful exchange with the great master. But it was, that stays with you. The answer to the question why, there's nothing there. Absolute nothing. So what are you worried about? I want to become enlightened. Let's stop trying. And then you become enlightened. Nothing there. So that's a great insight. So as you're meditating, what's left? Nothing. There's nothing there, so you've got nothing to lose. So when you come across fear in this meditation, you're getting there, your hands are disappearing, your body's disappearing. Ah, what's going on? Ah, shut up. Just stop interfering with enlightenment. It's not your, none of your business that you're disappearing. You know, the whole body disappears and you can't feel anything. You're actually frozen. Ah! Shut up! It's nothing to do with you, your body. Your will totally vanishes. You can't do anything. No more will. Ah! It didn't belong to you anyway. So someone's taking it away again. It wasn't yours anyway. It's like sort of, you know, in these hard economic times, you get these repossession agents that come and just repossess your house and repossess your car. That's what the Buddha is doing, is repossessing your body, repossessing your mind, because you only lent it to you for a while. Now you've got to give it away again. Nothing to do with you. So what happens in this type of meditation you're doing now? You are letting go. And as you let things go, you realize, hey, that's true. It doesn't belong to me. You're experiencing this. It doesn't become something you work out as a theory. You rationalize it. It's something you experience. You disappearing. Everything you ever thought was you. Your family, your friends. Look, even your past. Why the heck do people attach to their past? Who did what to you? Yeah, it was bad stuff they did to you. Cruel stuff, mean stuff. They shouldn't have done it. Why do you attach to that? Why can't you just let it go? It's shit stuff. You're just the shit collector, putting the shit in your basket. You need to keep the eggs, throw the shit away, but it's better to throw the eggs away as well. Have a light basket. So why do you attach to the past? Because that's who you think you are. I remember going to this Grief and Loss conference with our old president, Dennis. He got me into this. So I gave a talk on the Buddhist attitude to grief and loss, basically that experience in the northeast of Thailand, not sort of, hadn't been influenced at all by Western culture, there was not any grief at all. Grief was absent from their cultural makeup. It was weird, it was strange, but that was true. And I didn't sort of misjudge it. I was there in the village. People lost their kids, their wife, their husband, young sort of things, tragedies. They never cried. They didn't have grief. Weird, but true. So grief is a cultural addition to loss. So I gave a talk on that. And then this woman came out to me afterwards, and she really hammered me. She was so angry at me. Not because she didn't believe what I was saying, but because she was one of these people who went to every grief and loss conference in the country, because she had some tragic loss in her life. And she was Mrs. Grief, and I was telling her to let herself disappear. She had become so attached to her grief. That's her personality. That's who she was. That was her main attribute in life. I was a woman who'd lost her daughter in tragic circumstances. When I asked her to let that go and suggested it was possible, I was suggesting that she destroy everything she thought she was. To her, that was just unacceptable. She was so afraid, she really hammered and got very angry at me. We attach so much to that past, we become that past. That's who we are. So it's great to be able just to say, I don't need to be that, I can just let it go. I'm not the victim of abuse. I'm not the alcoholic. I'm not the drug addict. I'm not the sort of murderer. I'm not the thief. You can totally let go of everything to do with your past. That's what anatta teaches you. It's not you. Let it go. And you can be totally free. I'm not talking about not being responsible, because when you let it go, you are free. You are responsible. And you're a much better person when you let go of that burden. So, none of this has anything to do with you. So even, how has your meditation been the past week? Who knows, nothing to do with me. You had jhana, you've been sleeping all the time, you've been absolutely crazy, and on the edge of psychosis. Who cares, nothing to do with me. So let it totally go. And then you're not attached, you're not making yourself out of the past. Some people make the self out of their future. What are you going to be? Yeah, I know it's going to be nimitta sivana jhana. You're making yourself out of the future again. Just forget everything about the future and the past. Don't make yourself out of anything. It's nothing to do with you, future and past. So you can totally let it go. The reason why you find it hard to let go of the past and the future is because that's where you think you live. That's you. I'm the great planner. I'm the great manager. I can organize things. I can make it work. Shut up. And let go, disappear, vanish. And it's the same with thinking. A lot of times people, they associate so much with their thoughts. I am the thinker. I've got great thoughts, you know. I've written 2 or 3 books about my thoughts, and they've been published. What a great thinker I am. That's a stupid thing. That's nothing to do with you. So you let go of all your thoughts so you can be absolutely silent. That's such a relief. But in silence, most of you has disappeared. You don't know who you are. It's great not to know who you are. So trust in that silence. Trust in your vanishing. And your body, you think you are your body. How much time do you spend worrying about your body? Exercising it, feeding it, making sure it gets the right food. Even if you eat. See, my body doesn't behave. It's got cramp. Stop it. I'm going to move it out here. It has nothing to do with me. Just when it wants to do that, it does it. So, your body, nothing to do with you. Good, bad, old or young. So, after a while, you can let it go. So, in your meditation, when you get very, very peaceful, your body disappears. Why is it that you won't let it go? Get that insight, it's because you think it is my body and I don't want it to go. Why is it when people say, go to the doctor and say, I'm terribly sorry ma'am, your cancer is terminal, there's nothing I can do. You're going to die. Why do you get upset? It's It's a wonderful thing. If you get cancer and going to die young, it's great you don't have to go to old people's home. Have you ever been to old people's homes? Terrible place to end up. So if you get cancer and say you're going to die, you know, before you're 60, whoopee! Way! I've avoided the old people's homes. Great, marvellous. And then if you've been a good person, you get a new body, you can start again with a... You don't want an old body, you know, old bodies, they really suck. So, you know, it's just like you have an old car. Why keep the old car? Trade it in, get a new one, quick. So, but the reason is, it's not logical to get upset when you're going to die. It's only because you really think you are your body, and the body's got something to do with you. So that once you meditate and realize this body's got nothing to do with you whatsoever, at all, in any which way, it means not only you're not going to be afraid of dying, it means you're going to let go of your body, get to nimitta stage very easy. So one of the reasons why people can't get to nimitta stage is they're stuck with this body and they just will not let it go. So you see, this body's nothing to do with me, it's suffering, it's just a waste of time. So that's why you don't force the body. You respect it, make it nice and comfortable, so comfortable it can disappear. How can you go to sleep at night? Can you go to sleep at night on a bed of nails? Now, can you just throw all your blankets off, really chilly, and go to sleep? You've got to be comfortable to go to sleep. Similar, but not quite the same sort of comfort to get into deep meditation. Because if you've got too much pain or aches, you're never going to go to sleep, you're never going to get into deep meditation. You can't let go of your body. It's just screaming at you, won't let you go. So you let go of this body, and when it disappears, oh, what a relief. As I was saying yesterday, last night, a couple of people asked me, why is it so happy? Why is there a bliss better than sex when you get to nimittas, and especially in jhanas? It's obvious. You get the inside. It's as plain as, again, as the nose in front of your face. You get insight that this five senses and this body must be a pain, because when it's gone, it's bliss. Just like, you know, some of these people, you know, can become so irritating. They're always around you, irritating, irritating. When they disappear, ah, he's gone. Ah, oh, so nice. And just like this body, ah, body's gone. Ah, oh, so nice. Freedom at last. That's what it's like when the body disappears. And so the insight is just so easy to see. This body is a pain. It hurts. Even in its, when it's healthy, it still demands so much of you. But when it's gone, oh, freedom. And that's the bliss of the first jhana. The second jhana, oh, just will. I gave that simile. As will, as a guard. You're in this prison cell, and the guard will not let you sit still. Try harder. Don't try so hard. Come on, make peace. What did Ajahn Brahm say? What should I do next? Come on, you're not doing anything. You're being lazy. You're being too diligent. You're sleeping too much. You're not sleeping enough. Ajahn Brahm said you should rest, but then I should do some more effort because someone else said I should do this, and now I think I should do that. I should do some metta meditation. No, walking meditation is very good. I just need a cup of tea. That mind, it never gives you any peace at all. And you cherish that will, which is, you know, just like this sadistic guard. Never let you sit still for a few minutes. You should be doing something. It never lets you rest. It never lets you be free. Even at night time, it's sort of talking to you in your sleep, giving you all these dreams and telling you what to do. Once you notice what that, I call it the guard, the sadistic prison guard, the commandant of your mind. Once you realize what that is, now your will, you think, gee, this thing which I've cherished, which I try to strengthen by saying, come on, will, be stronger so I can get into my deep meditations. Come on, will, be stronger so I can just, you know, resist the fish and chips and exercise more and get up earlier and do more. Come on, will, you can do it. That strengthening of the will is just giving more power to that prison guard. You find you get more and more stressed. Less freedom. Certainly less ability to meditate. So for me it becomes the point, meditation, just let go. Prison guard, shut up. It doesn't order me around anymore. There's no goals, nothing to do. I'm not told where to go or how to be by me. Just relax, let go. And then you just go into deep meditation, so easy. And you go to a place where the world just can't get to you. And that is bliss, that second jhana and beyond. You experience those things, and then just like, oh, the body disappearing, there's so much bliss. The will disappearing, so much bliss. Why did I ever want to sort of keep this will going? That will creates so much suffering for you. Never leaves you alone. Are you perfect yet? Are you good enough? Will say, no, 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 try hard, you can be better. Are you comfortable yet? Will said, no, no, you can scratch this and it'll be better. You can move that and it'll be much more comfortable. And it never is. The will keep you moving and moving and moving and moving. Round and round, not just this life, but many lives without end. And it's actually the will which will drive you from the end of this life to your new life, to the next life. Will is the force which takes you from one incarnation to the next. Driving ever forward, never giving you any stop, never any release. Except when you get into the second jhanas. First time in your conscious existence that you can really be at peace. Because no one is telling you what to do. Not even you are telling you what to do. You can really relax and be still. That's why it's called peace of mind, stillness. That's an incredible experience. So as you practice this is not samatha, just samatha. You're just going to enjoy yourself, you're not going to get anything afterwards. When you come out of these states, you've been into an amazing experience, weird experience. You've seen places where the body doesn't exist and you're blissing out, where there's no will at all, you're absolutely still, and you're in more bliss. Of course you're going to see that the body is dukkha, is suffering, the will is suffering. That's going to change a lot of the way you look at life. It's the insight which is going to change you. The last simile which I'm going to use is one of the most powerful ones. I've mentioned it before, but I'm running out of time. And that is the simile of the tadpole and the frog. Tadpole, born in water, grown up in water, lived all its life in water, cannot know what water is. Even if tadpole goes to Abhidharma classes on water and takes a PhD in water, never will he be able to understand or she be able to understand what water is. It's just all theory and concept. Reason why is because it's been around water all its life. It's lived with water. There's no moment of its existence when water hasn't been there. A tadpole cannot comprehend what water is. Can learn about it, conceive about it, but not know it. But one day, little tadpole grows into frog and jumps up onto the dry land. And when tadpole jumps up on the dry land, they don't need to think, what should I do now? It's obvious that something is missing. Something which was always there for tadpole is now totally gone and vanished. And that is weird. That's just like getting into a first jhana. Something's missing, and that's weird. I mean, really missing. And that's your body and five senses. First time in your conscious experience, the body has been removed from you. Now you know what mind is. What body is. You can't know that without that first jhana. That's why, as far as I'm concerned, other people might argue differently, but my experience tells me no way can you understand what a body is and five senses are without an experience of jhana. No way you can understand what mind is without at least that experience. And as you go deeper and deeper and deeper, second jhana, little frog has jumped out of the lake of will. It's not there anymore. That's the experience of a second jhana. It's blissful. That's what you experience within the jhana, but afterwards you think, gee, something was missing. Something which was always there for me, the ability to do something, to choose, to move, to think, to plan. That ability is totally gone. Now you know what will is. That's why I don't really think you can get an understanding of the nature of craving and its problem and how it forms a self without a second jhana experience. It doesn't make any sense to me. Knowing those things and knowing how they work This is the stages of letting go which uncover delusions which you cannot think your way through. It's not a question of having a rational mind and being intelligent and clever. It's a matter of just, you haven't had the experience yet to really know what's going on. When you have those experiences, they just change the way you look at things. You've been out of the pond. You know what dry land is. You know what absence of water is. And that's where you understand about the Four Noble Truths, the body is suffering, and the will doesn't belong to you, and it's a pain in the neck. And also, it's subject to cessation. Anicca doesn't mean rise and fall, rise and fall, rise and fall, coming and going. Anybody knows that? What anicca means is things which were always there are subject to vanishing. I gave a simile. It's like watching a TV set. The TV set with the five channels on it. Seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. Yeah, you can turn those channels off and have the blank screen. That's not anicca. Anicca is when you've got the TV screen with the five channels on. And then one day you're just sitting there watching the news. And the channel turns off. And the TV disappears. Vanishes. It's no longer there anymore. Now that's weird. Because TVs are not supposed to vanish. Especially if they're expensive plasma screen ones. If you look, it's not covered in the warranty. 5 foot wide plasma screen TVs. Yeah, they might break down, but they're not supposed to suddenly disappear from the universe. But that's what happens with your mind. You're watching, watching, watching. That's what happens with the body. It just vanishes. Where the hell has it gone? Will. Where'd it go? It just vanished. That's anicca. Something which is always there, subject to cessation, vanishing, gone. Not gone somewhere, but just gone. So when you're enlightened, what happens? That's the final vanishing act. You're gone. Not gone somewhere. Vanished. Anicca. You. Bye-bye. That's a talk on insight. Bye-bye. Okay, so I've got over time as usual. But are there any questions or comments about the talk on insight and how it works, how you're going to vanish and disappear without any remainder? Yeah. Laziness is a brilliant path to meditation. I really support laziness. I remember the other day that somebody reminded me that the great British philosopher, Lord Russell, Bertrand Russell, he wrote this amazing essay, In Praise of Idleness, is one of his greatest works. In Praise of Idleness. It's a classic essay saying that, you know, that we think that by working hard we're going to get somewhere. And he was saying, actually, in idleness we get our best ideas. Not only that, but we can relax and have a good life. Why are we sort of total sort of addicts to doing something? And so much so that laziness is considered to be sort of one of the worst things we can possibly do. I remember in Christianity I was taught the devil makes work for idle hands. When I heard that, I thought having idle hands must be good if the Christians don't like it. That's my perverse mind. The devil makes work for idle hands. So if you have idle hands, it doesn't make. You get enlightened when you have idle hands. It's too many other people are doing things. You don't need to do so much. So if you are going to be lazy, Kamanti, be lazy, fully lazy. Just sit there. I don't even want to be enlightened. I'm going to be totally lazy. I'm not going to move. My mind is not going to move. I'm going to be too lazy to even think. Because people aren't lazy at all. They just don't know how to be lazy. They haven't had the same monastic training in laziness that I've had. So they think they're being lazy, but they're not being lazy. They're thinking about this and they're fantasizing about that. They're not being lazy at all. So if we're really lazy, you sit here. And just let the body totally go. Body, I don't care about you. Bye-bye. Thinking. No, I'm even too lazy to worry about the future and the past.
so lazy, can't even think. So lazy, even breathing in and breathing out is none of my business. So lazy, just watch jhanas. Too lazy to keep the first jhana, so just go to the second. So if you're going to be lazy, be 100% fully lazy. Take it to be an art form, to be perfected in laziness. But laziness doesn't mean just, oh, I'm just going to go. See, that's doing something. So do absolutely nothing. Just stop. Right there. Just push this in now. That great story about that little novice with Ajahn Chah. I don't know, sometimes you may be enjoying the talk, sometimes you may not be enjoying the talks, and sometimes you'll be looking at your watch and thinking, when is Ajahn Brahm going to stop so I can go and have my cup of tea? And I didn't sleep much last night. When is he going to stop so I can go back to my room and start having a sleep? When is he going to stop? And this happened in Thailand when Ajahn Chah didn't give 1 hour talk, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. Sometimes he just went on and on and on. And it was not inspiring. Please don't think that Ajahn Chah was an inspiring teacher, because a lot of the time it was just rubbish. But every now and again he would say something inspiring. It was worth waiting for. But a lot of the time, and you ask anyone else who was with him, it was just same old stories, boring, 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 just rubbish. But then every now and again, you know, he would say a jewel. And those jewels were incredible, so it really was worth waiting for. So it was one of these talks just going on and on and on and on. And there was this little novice in the audience. And he was thinking, when is Ajahn Chah going to stop? I'm a little novice. I need to have my sleep. I'm not like these monks who are tough guys. You know, I'm only sort of a small boy. You know, I need my sleep. You know, I only became a monk because I had to, because my mum and dad forced me into this. I didn't really choose. What am I doing this? When will Ajahn Chah stop? And that became like a mantra for him. When's he going to stop? 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 But then what happened next? He was saying this mantra, when is he going to stop, when is he going to stop? In the same way you say the mantra, you know, that I'm going to die, that's for sure, I will die, that's for sure, or good enough and good enough. Those mantras, sometimes it clicks. You get it. I will die, that's for sure. You really see it. Good enough, you really see it. When will he stop? The little novice saw it. He said, when will I stop? And then the novice stopped. One of those great experiences, when he opened his eyes, it was early in the morning. Didn't know how long he'd meditated, maybe 3 or 4 or 5 hours. The talk had finished, the monks had done their chanting and bowed and gone back to their rooms to have some rest. And little novice had been sitting there all the time, blissed out of his little mind. First time he got a nice meditation, a nice jhana. And how he did that? Stop. Come on, stop. Stop. But he got it, he really stopped. He stopped moving, stopped doing, stopped craving. He was totally lazy. And that's where he got into his first jhana. So you try that. But you know, the word is one thing, and what it's pointing to is something else. So when you see where it's pointing to, and actually get that, everything stops, the whole world stops. And that's bliss. So there we go, another inspiring story for you. And that's how close it was, a stupid novice really going out of his mind with craziness and hatred for the teacher. And then just one moment of seeing insight, stopping and understanding what it meant, goes into a very, very deep meditation. So, you're not that far. If you're crazy like that novice, not that far. All you need to do is, like that little novice, say stop. I'm going to stop anyway, so. Interviews now, so enjoy the rest of today.